On Sunday, the 9th of April, a handful of well-heeled passengers boarded an 8-seater Cessna Citation Sovereign business jet. Arriving at Chicago's smaller Midway Airport a few minutes before departure, they were whisked onto the tarmac and slipped into their leather seats. After takeoff, the passengers on flight EJA342 tucked into their customised meals, along with wines chosen to match by experts at Wine Spectator magazine. Less than 2 hours later, quicker than the time a commercial jet would take, the twin-engine flight had touched down in Boston. On the other side of the city, a doctor from Kentucky was sitting on board a plane at Chicago's largest airport, O'Hare. The airport's one of the busiest in the world, and more than a quarter of all flights that go out of O'Hare are delayed. After everyone had boarded United Flight 3411, a flight attendant announced that four passengers would have to get off to make room for airline employees. The airline initially offered flight vouchers, then when no one accepted, they announced they'd pick four passengers at random. Three of the passengers left the plane voluntarily. The doctor, David Dow, refused, saying he had to see patients in Louisville the next morning. United Airlines staff called aviation security officers who dragged him off the plane. The contrast between flights EJA342 and UA3411 symbolises much of what's changed in society over recent decades. Over the past 10 years, the private jet market has doubled, with increasing numbers of Americans, and Australians for that matter, being willing to pay up to $8,000 an hour to charter their own plane. Meanwhile, the flying experience for most passengers has become worse. Most don't end up with a broken nose and missing teeth like David Dow. But legroom has shrunk, while surcharges for snacks and baggage have grown. It's doubtless a good thing that flying to new places become cheaper and more accessible. But in the process, a gap has opened up in how we get around. At the top, private jets abound. Emirates has introduced in-flight showers for first-class passengers on its A380. At the bottom, United Airlines recently announced its basic economy fare, which gives passengers no choice of seating and allows them to bring on only one small tote bag. Inequality is everywhere, even in the skies. This is the third and final of my Just Ideas talks on inequality. The first talk, given at the University of Sydney, was focused on why inequality matters. The second, hosted by Per Capita, sought to explain the rise in Australian inequality. Today, my focus will be on what we can do to reduce inequality. It seems fitting to do this at Canberra. I'm grateful to the Australian National University's Crawford School of Public Policy for hosting me, and acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we're meeting today. Reducing inequality is a big call. In his new book, Stanford's Walter Schneidel looks at inequality over history and concludes that only four things have made society substantially more equal: epidemics, pandemics, state collapse, war. I'd be relieved to know that I don't intend to advocate any of those four as a means to a more equal society. But I do mention Schneidel's work because it's a useful reminder that the task is difficult, and that even if we adopt fairer policies, progressives shouldn't expect to see a radical transformation in the level of inequality in our society. Still, it's a task that's worth embarking on. Since I gave the second Just Ideas talk, the great inequality scholar Tony Atkinson has died, losing his life to cancer on New Year's Day. This talk is dedicated to Tony. Tony's passion wasn't just to measure inequality, but to do something about it. He built from his early work on inequality metrics and became increasingly focused on policy remedies. Tony's final book, Inequality, What Can Be Done, is jam-packed with solutions to reduce inequality. I'll draw a few ideas from it today, but there's no substitute for reading it yourself. So what can we do? Well, let's start from the beginning. No, actually, let's start before the beginning. The womb is an amazing organ. It provides developing babies with all the nutrients they need to grow from a single cell to an infant weighing a few kilograms. But even in that environment, we know that development differs. Stress, toxins, micronutrients all affect how a child develops in the womb. Babies born too light, below 2.5 kilograms, or too early, before 37 weeks, are more likely to have health complications, less likely to do well at school, and less likely to earn a decent income. In richer Australian households, only 3% of babies are of low birth weight. In poorer households, that figure is 7%. Similarly, in affluent households, only 4% of babies are born early. In disadvantaged households, that figure is 9%. Reducing pre-birth inequality requires reducing the share of pregnant mothers who smoke, drink, use drugs, or are subject to intimate partner violence. One of the most promising interventions seems to be nurse home visits, though as a Cochrane review pointed out, we still need to learn more about why some home visiting programs work while others do not. The Cochrane review also points to some surprising findings, such as the fact that financial incentives seem to be particularly effective in helping pregnant women quit smoking. The vital importance of a healthy pregnancy also reinforces the value of paid parental leave, properly funded legal aid for family violence victims, and the ability to visit a doctor for a checkup without worrying about the cost. Next, there's education. Now, you're no doubt familiar with Australia's fall in test scores over recent years. From the 1960s to the early 2000s, the literacy and numeracy of 14 to 15-year-olds either flatlined or fell slightly. From 2000 to 2015, international PISA exams show Australian 15-year-olds going backwards in maths, reading and science, with the drop equivalent to 3 to 6 months of learning over this 15-year period. Most recently, NAPLAN results for grades 3, 5, 7 and 9 show only slight improvement over the period 2008 to 2016. However, while all this is probably familiar to you, you may be less aware about educational inequality, the gap between students in the top 10th and the bottom 10th of performance. This so-called 90-10 gap is a measure of inequality within the schooling system, and it's been shown to correlate strongly with income inequality. Using data from the OECD's latest PISA exams, I looked at the performance of the top 10th and bottom 10th of test score performance. Our top 10th of students are very good. Not surprisingly, our best outperform the average student in any country. But actually, they also do pretty well against the top performers elsewhere. Take a student from the top 10th of the Australian distribution and send them on exchange to any advanced nation, and presuming they can hold their own the language, they'll do well in class. But then there's the bottom 10th. Australia's lowest performing students are well below the average in any advanced country. Indeed, if you wanted to find a country where the bottom 10th of Australian students are on par, you'd need to be thinking of nations such as Brazil, Indonesia, or the Dominican Republic. Subtract the bottom 10th score from the top 10th score, and you've got a measure of educational inequality. For science and reading, Australia's level of educational inequality puts us in the top quarter of the advanced world. And this isn't a ranking you want to top. For maths, our test score inequality puts us in the top third of the advanced world. When I measured the size of the gap, I couldn't quite believe what I saw at first. In each of these subjects, the typical student at the 90th percentile is more than 5 years of achievement ahead of their counterpart at the 10th percentile. Remember, this is a grade 9 test. So the 90th percentile students are scoring at year 12 level, while the 10th percentile students are performing at year 7 level. They're a whole high school apart. The same holds for adult tests of literacy and numeracy. Measured in terms of educational inequality among the whole population, Australia's test score gap ranks us in the top third of advanced countries for educational inequality. Ask a random group of Australians to critique an essay, count calories, or calculate mortgage rates, and you'll find bigger differences in Australia than in most advanced nations. Raising educational attainment for the bottom performers requires delivering needs-based funding. Under the former Labor government, states and territories received additional federal funding, but only if they contributed an extra $1 for every $2 from the Commonwealth. All jurisdictions committed to national education targets, including a 90% Year 12 completion rate by 2020, and for Australia to be placed among the five highest performing countries in the world by 2025. Among the strategies for achieving those targets were stronger teacher education standards, early intervention for students struggling to read, and a better principal performance framework. With the change of government in 2013, schools will lose billions of dollars in needs-based funding. And the Coalition's no-strings-attached approach absolved states of any requirement to increase school funding. National targets still exist in legislation, but they're rarely mentioned by the federal government. In ensuring that resources are spent the best way, we can also learn from international examples. America's What Works Clearinghouse and Britain's Education Endowment Foundation are building a strong evidence base in those countries that allow state and local education authorities to confidently choose the best interventions. In Australia, we don't have an equivalent. Moreover, we tend not to use hard science around evaluating education interventions. Like medicine in the 19th century, the main focus is on expert opinion and case studies rather than rigorous controlled experiments. For the best performing students, this mightn't matter much. They likely have home environments with pushy parents, plenty of books, and strong social networks. But for the bottom tenth, school resources and how they're spent can mean the difference between success or failure, not just in school, but in the job market. Now, social policy. In terms of its immediate impact on reducing inequality, no part of the Australian system does more to equalise incomes than the transfer system. If you think in terms of Gini coefficients, and let's face it, who doesn't? Then you can think of the Australian transfer system as reducing the Gini by around 10 points. That's roughly the difference in disposable income inequality between the United States and France. Australia's transfer system does twice as much to reduce inequality as our tax system, which I'll come to shortly. The genius of the Australian social safety net is that it is amazingly efficient at reducing inequality. Put one more dollar in the Australian social safety net and you reduce inequality by more than you would in any other nation in the world. As Peter Whiteford has pointed out, we spend relatively little on cash transfers, around 9% of national income, compared with 10 to 20% in the rest of the advanced world. And frankly, it's not that surprising. We have modest welfare spending, given that government is a smaller share of the economy in Australia than in most advanced countries. But what marks us out from other countries is that what we spend is highly targeted. In most advanced nations, only around a quarter of cash transfers are income tested. In Australia, three quarters of cash transfers are income tested. If anything, this trend has accentuated over recent years. Just think of the scrapping of the baby bonus and a number of bipartisan changes to family payments. Further changes to our welfare system should bear in mind three principles. that Australia's welfare system spends much less than most countries, that Australia's welfare system is better targeted than any other country, and that Australian inequality is at a post-war high. Mindless cuts to welfare system, to welfare spending, will increase inequality. Instead, we should be thinking about how to help working age adults get the skills and employment opportunities they need. In terms of ensuring that our social supports are targeted, portable and flexible, there's no better policy document than Jenny Macklin's thoughtful Growing Together report, released last year. As it happens, using social policy to reduce inequality is almost precisely the opposite of the suggestion that Australia adopt a universal basic income. Here's an illustration of how that might work out. Suppose we got rid of our current cash transfers and replaced them with a flat rate universal basic income. Current spending would support a payment of around $6,000 per person. Every millionaire, every billionaire would be thousands of dollars better off. Every pensioner would be in abject poverty, barely able to buy food, let alone afford the bills. Remember, Australia's social safety net reduces inequality by 10 Gini points. A universal basic income, by design, has zero impact on inequality. So scrapping the social safety net in favour of a universal basic income would increase the Gini by 10 points, making Australia as unequal as Latin America. Some argue that a universal basic income should be paid for by increasing taxes rather than by destroying our targeted welfare system. But I'm not sure they've considered how big the increase would need to be. Suppose we wanted the universal basic income to be the same amount as the single age pension, currently $23,000 including supplements. That would require an increase in taxes of $17,000 per person, or around 23% of GDP. That would make Australia's tax to GDP ratio among the highest in the world. So next time someone advocates a universal basic income, ask them how they'd like to pay for it. By making Australia the most unequal country in the world, or by making Australia the most highly taxed nation in the world. In tax policy, reducing inequality needs to become a more central part of policy design. When I was appointed Shadow Assistant Treasurer, a senior policy economist suggested I keep close at hand a table of the deadweight costs of different taxes and judge any tax proposal based on whether it reduced the economic drag on the economy. It's a useful rule of thumb, but it's not the whole picture. When inequality is high and rising, we also need to think about the distributional implications of tax changes. And frankly, we haven't always done that well enough. The 1975 Asprey Review, the 1999 Ralph Review, the 2015 Rethink discussion paper placed equity to one side. Even the excellent 2010 Henry Tax Review didn't put enough emphasis on inequality. One example of how this plays out is the upcoming expiry of the temporary budget repair levy in a little over 2 months' time, which will reduce the tax rate on incomes over $180,000 by 2 percentage points. Viewed through the lens of efficiency, this is nothing to go to the barricades over, given that income tax has a middling deadweight cost. But from an equity perspective, it's a travesty. The top 1% has doubled its share of national income over the past generation. Is it really fair to deliver a tax cut where more than 9/10 of the benefits will go to adults in the top 1%? When payment cuts for low-income households have been permanent, why should tax rises for high-income earners be temporary? And the same goes for capital gains tax and negative gearing. Those tax expenditures aren't merely inefficient, combining to drive down the home ownership rate to its lowest level in 60 years. They're also inequitable with half the benefits going to the top tenth of the population. In the case of negative gearing, the typical teacher or nurse gets less than $300 a year. The typical surgeon or anaesthetist gets over $3,000 a year. Another example of where putting equity into tax policy makes a difference is the transition from stamp duty to land tax. This reform, which has been implemented in the ACT and is being considered in South Australia, has typically been sold on equity on efficiency grounds. Stamp duty has one of the highest deadweight costs of any tax, while land tax has among the lowest deadweight costs. But it might be worth also considering the equity implications by looking at who pays stamp duty in Australia. To see this, I simply pulled up the Household Income and Labour Dynamics in Australia survey and asked the question, how wealthy are first home buyers compared with all homeowners? Turns out that first home buyers have, on average, about half the wealth of average homeowners. Now, admittedly, stamp duty is paid by all home buyers, and when you include purchases of investment properties, the pool of home buyers is similarly wealthy to the pool of homeowners. But to the extent that it falls on people buying their first home, stamp duty on first home buyers isn't just less efficient than land tax, it's also less equitable. Compared with homeowners, first home buyers are younger and poorer. In the future, today's home buyers will doubtless be older and more affluent, but that's not much comfort when you're asking them to pay the tax bill today. We also need to bring an inequality lens to competition policy. In my second Just Ideas talk, I discussed how work by Tony Atkinson had forced me as Shadow Minister for Competition to stop thinking of competition policy as just being a matter of efficiency and start thinking about its distributional consequences. We live in a society where some people shop in the supermarket without bothering to look at the prices. Others check every price, then anxiously monitor the total at the cash register, sometimes embarrassedly asking the cashier to put aside an item for later. For disadvantaged Australians, competition policy isn't a luxury, it's a necessity. And yet, as Adam Triggs and I found when we analysed nearly 500 Australian industries, most are concentrated markets. When petrol companies engage in tacit collusion to increase prices, the crunch is hardest on people who buy fuel $20 at a time, not those who fill the tank and charge it to the corporate fuel card. Uncompetitive markets may be the culprit for several worrying economic trends we've seen in Australia, including more wage inequality, a rising capital share, lower business investment, declining research spending, and a drop in new business formation. Recent OECD research has shown a widening productivity gap between frontier firms and laggard firms, and has suggested that might be related to the market power that big firms are able to deploy. New analysis across US industries find that rising market concentration has led to a fall in the labour share, with superstar firms using markups, excessive markups, to increase their profits. Market concentration is a significant challenge, and I don't pretend to have all the answers. But a starting point is to toughen our competition laws. We should increase civil penalties under the Australian Consumer Law for a maximum of $1.1 million to $10 million, bringing consumer penalties in line with competition penalties. We should adopt the European Union's penalty system for anti-competitive conduct, which is based on 30% of the annual sales. We should increase the competition watchdog's litigation budget. We should give it a market studies function. But we can also, should also ensure that competition, that inequality is within the remit of competition laws. For example, courts should apply higher penalties for conduct that targets or disproportionately impacts disadvantaged Australians. The competition watchdog should have an explicit legislative mandate to put the most vulnerable first. Addressing economic inequality also means addressing the widening social gap in Australia. Its work by Bruce Bradbury has shown the income gaps within our cities have grown larger since the 1990s. Compared with two decades ago, well-paid workers are less likely to live in places with low average incomes. Bruce sums up his finding with the old joke. What did the rich man say to the poor man? Nothing. They never met. The main risk of social bifurcation is that policymakers and commentators become disconnected with the reality of lived experience in Australia. Looking out from the boardroom, the newsroom, or indeed the parliament, it's easy to forget that half of all Australian households have disposable incomes below $80,000. A few years ago, when Fairfax asked its readers to estimate where they stood on the income distribution, 2/3 of respondents thought they were further down the distribution than they really were. The problem was particularly acute at the top. Among those whose actual incomes placed them in the top 10%, 4 out of 5 thought they were poorer. Among those whose actual incomes placed them in the top 1%, 5 out of 6 thought they were poorer. If there's one thing that unites the top 1%, it's thinking that they're in the bottom 99%. With poverty greatest in outer suburbia and in regional Australia, it's easy for those who live in the central cities not to notice the extent of deprivation. Moreover, Australians are less likely to be involved in organisations that promote class mixing. Church attendance is down. Membership in community organisations such as Scouts, Guides, the RSL and Rotary has dwindled. As they have waned, so too have the chances that people of different backgrounds will rub shoulders with one another. In my 2010 book, Disconnected, I suggested 10 strategies for building community, ranging from hosting street parties to using technology to build face-to-face interactions. As Shadow Minister for Charities and Not-for-Profits, I've been holding forums with charities to exchange ideas on building membership. Today, I want to suggest another idea, Deliberation Day. Originally proposed by academics Bruce Ackerman and James Fishkin, Deliberation Day is the notion that in election years, we should set aside a civic holiday on which citizens are encouraged to come together and debate the nation's future. It's easy to dismiss as a virtuous pipe dream, but there's been a recent resurgence in town hall meeting attendance in both Australia and the United States. Delighting Bill Shorten, who's held nearly 50 of them around the country, and shocking some US Republican congressmen who end up cancelling their town hall meetings. Even if only 1 in 20 eligible voters turned out, an Australian Deliberation Day would still create a civic conversation among 800,000 people, making it the biggest civic conversation ever held in Australia. On the industrial front, we should never lose track of the role that unions play in reducing inequality. Unions bargain for pay equity within and across workplaces and fight particularly hard for those at the bottom. That's why falling union membership explains about 1/3 of the rise in Australian inequality over the past generation. Laws that make it harder for unions to access workplaces, bargain collectively, or engage on an equal footing with management are more likely to increase inequality. As I noted in the last Just Ideas talk, cutting weekend penalty rates will hurt low-wage workers the most. Unions are one of the most powerful social forces for egalitarianism. And if you'll allow me a sentence with 2 radical ideas, building bigger unions is one of the best ways of making Australia more equal. A single speech can't hope to span the policy gamut of inequality ideas. What I've mentioned here should be considered an appetiser, not a banquet. To the extent possible, I've tried not to repeat the proposals I made in Battlers and Billionaires, and have restrained myself on some of my perennial favourites, including randomised trials, income contingent loans, and behavioural economics tweaks. And even a list of things I've missed out is going to miss out plenty. The inequality-busting work afoot on the Labor side of politics includes Bill Shorten's leadership on expanding the Closing the Gap targets, Brendan O'Connor's work on defending weekend penalty rates, Catherine King's work on strengthening Medicare and preventive health, Tanya Plibersek's work on ensuring everyone with the ability to win a place at university can take up that opportunity, Terry Butler's push for marriage equality, Chris Bowen's pledge to task the Productivity Commission with producing 5 yearly reports on how we're going as a nation with improving equality of opportunity and social mobility, Wayne Swan's work with the Chifley Institute's Inclusive Prosperity Commission, which he co-chairs with Michael Cooney, especially their report, Inequality, the Facts and the Future, Linda Burney's expose of the robo-debt debacle, and Jim Chalmers' forthcoming book with Mike Quigley on automation and inequality. And indeed, if we're talking about global inequality, Penny Wong's push for a stronger Australian aid program, Shane Newman's advocacy for a more generous refugee program, and Mark Butler's work to ensure that Australia meets our climate targets. For the Labor side of politics, egalitarianism isn't an abstract idea. Reducing inequality is a principle that undergirds how we would govern. In 1982, opposition leader Bill Hayden was speaking to a business lunch when a member of the audience asked him for his view on imposing a tax on robots. Hayden swiftly responded, "We're not proposing to tax robots at the moment." But 35 years later, in a February 2017 interview with Quartz magazine, Bill Gates proposed just that, a robot tax. Gates clearly cares about inequality, and his foundation's done an enormous amount to reduce global poverty. But a robot tax would be a terrible way of addressing inequality. Surgical robots reduce medical complications. Industrial robots make safer machines. Driverless cars may soon dramatically cut the road toll. As Larry Summers points out, Gates makes the same error that advocates of tariffs often make against trade, writing, "Gates' robot tax risks essentially being protectionism against progress." The fact that a brilliant thinker like Bill Gates can go astray in the question of how to reduce inequality reminds us of how hard the task is. And yet, as Tony Atkinson reminded us, it need not be beyond our wit to take it on. As Atkinson wrote in his final book, "In this book, I set out concrete policy proposals that could, I believe, bring about a genuine shift in the distribution of income towards less inequality. Drawing on the lessons of history and taking a fresh look through distributional eyes at the underlying economics, I seek to show what could be done now to reduce the extent of inequality. I do so in a spirit of optimism. The world faces great problems, but collectively, we're not helpless in the face of forces outside our control. The future is very much in our hands." May Tony's energy, ideas and optimism inspire us to work for a world that isn't just more affluent, but also fairer, more ethical and more equal. Thanks very much. This speech is provided as part of my Andrew Lee Speeches and Conversations podcast, available on iTunes. I also run a second podcast called The Good Life, about living a happier, healthier, or more ethical life. If you're interested, you can find it via iTunes, Stitcher, or your favourite podcast app. Just search for Good Life, Andrew Lee. I hope you enjoy it.